Now, we had a big response to our recent item about snake bites. That was on the Health Report on October 11th. We thought what a better way to answer some of these questions than to put them to the expert herself, Christina Zdanek. Tegan, you're going to channel Christina in answering those questions. But the first question comes from Melanie. I'm an emergency doctor at a large regional hospital in New South Wales where we deal with lots of snake bites. We have an eminent toxicologist on staff, and I've also been involved in writing one of our snake bite protocols. I listened with interest to your recent interview with Dr. Christina Zdanek regarding snake bite treatment. She mentioned that patients should insist that the bandage be taken off slowly over 1 hour. This is not standard practice in Australia. Does she have any evidence for this? I'd be really interested in this and possibly amending our protocols.
Well, yes, I am channeling Christina because we put these questions to her and she wrote back via email. Of course, Christina is a toxinologist at the University of Queensland, and she says the fact that slow bandage removal in hospital is not standard is one of the reasons why she wanted to make this piece, because there's no paper about this topic because we can't study it in humans. We've got to rely on the principles of snake bite first aid and some clear snake bite cases where a rapid onset of symptoms developed after a quick removal of the bandage. And she says, number three, common sense. So she says, keeping the bandage on does no permanent damage, and removing the bandage over the course of an hour enables a gentle increase in symptoms. And she does offer to discuss for more further training if anyone's interested.
And Rachel writes, I've just been listening to your podcast on snake bites and want to ask about immobilisation. We do a lot of walking on the Biberman track in WA. If there was to be a snake bite after the limb has been splintered and bandaged, would it be better to wait until the medics can come, which could be a while depending on the remoteness of the track, or try and carry the person back to the car? I know you said Aboriginal people would remain 5 days without moving, so I'm assuming the former.
Yes, well, Christina says the short answer is yes, wait. The key with surviving a snake bite is to bandage and immobilise the limb, stay still and wait for help to arrive. If you put it on properly and you don't move a muscle, the bandage can buy you time, hours of time, 6 to 12 hours before antivenom may be needed if it's done correctly. So that was Christina's feedback, but we've got more questions, Norman, from people emailing us at healthreport@abc.net.au, and one of them actually relates to last week's feature from Carl Smith about animals in medicine. Mary wanted to say something about the animal body part transplants feature that Carl gave us last week, saying this was a fascinating program. I trained as a nurse at St Vincent's Hospital in Melbourne between 1963 and 1966. And Mary says she vividly remembers caring for a delightful man who had pig valves put into his heart. He was a butcher. There are a few of these surgeries, but I don't think any of them survived for very long. Thank you for your program.
Well, in the early days, that might be right, but it's very common to get pig valves. And I think that Kevin Rudd had one put in.
Really?
Yeah.
So I wonder whether maybe people weren't surviving in those days because you would only put them in someone who really didn't have much else in terms of hope.
Yeah. We actually did a feature on this on the Health Report many years ago, and the history of heart surgery is quite fraught. You would never get away with it now ethically, but a lot of the early patients died. They were willing to have it. They knew the risks, but there were a lot of people who perished, to be blunt, in order for high quality cardiac surgery to survive in himself.
It seems to be a common story in medicine. Katie's got a question. Well, it sort of sounds like an ad for her husband's exercise physiology business, but I'll read you the story and you can make up your own mind. She tore her medial meniscus a couple of years ago, was told that she would need to have surgery on her knee, but her husband, who's an exercise physiologist, said, no, give rehab a go first. And she was very good at being very consistent with her exercise. She was healed up. She was back at CrossFit within 6 months. But their neighbour was told that she needed two knee replacements for her moderate osteoarthritis. She wasn't even in any pain. She was told that she needed surgery, and Katie's husband said that she was weak and overweight, and that probably was contributing to the knee pain. Anyway, Katie's written in because of our episode about orthopaedic surgery, Norman. I just wonder if you've got any comments about this surgery being recommended.
Well, look, what we said then was, if you take, say, torn meniscus, that's the cartilage, little wafers of cartilage that sit inside your knee joint. If you were to do an MRI, take 55-year-olds off the street and they've actually done this, and do an MRI in one knee, regardless of whether you've got pain or not, just any 55-year-old off the street, a very significant percentage will have a torn meniscus, a torn cartilage, and they wouldn't know it. Some will have pain, some won't. It's almost a normal part of aging. I just think one has to be careful. And when we were talking to Ian Harris on the show, he was, in a previous episode actually, he was actually talking about how hip replacements are much more reliable in terms of getting benefit from them when you need it. Knee replacements have a bit of variability and you can go through some rehabilitation and just see whether you really need it or not before you decide to go ahead with it. And some people do drop off the list. So there is a bit of variability here.
You've got some good questions that you sort of have as a rule of thumb, though, when people are being recommended to have any sort of surgery or intervention.
That's right. So the questions are, first of all, what are the chances of benefit? What are the chances of harm? What alternatives are there? And what happens if you do nothing?
Yep. Yep. That's all that part of patient-centered care and people being really informed in their decisions.
And also, what are your expectations? Because if your expectations are that I want to run a marathon, there might be a different process that the surgeon would go through with you than if I just want to get rid of the pain, because sometimes getting rid of the pain is not what is not the result you get from a knee replacement. You might get a reduction in pain. So there's a lot of expectations to be set, and there's not a surgeon who doesn't want you to get better as a result of the operation for it to be worth it.
Absolutely. And one more question from David, who says he recently caught a news item on another program, I think, citing a new study into the effectiveness of low-dose aspirin as an adjunct therapy to prevent CVA.
So CVA is cerebral vascular accidents. So that's stroke around the CVD, which is cardiovascular disease.
Yes, so he goes on to say some GPs prescribe aspirin, statins, antihypertensives as the gold standard for heart health. And he was wondering about earlier reports that enteric-coated aspirin was beneficial in limiting colon cancer. I think he's just sort of wondering what the role of aspirin is in medicine at the moment.
Okay, so aspirin, if you've not had, say, a temporary stroke or a stroke itself, and it's got to be a clot-based stroke, then there's no benefit from aspirin. In other words, if you just take aspirin because I'd like one day to prevent myself having a stroke or indeed a heart attack, but you've got no evidence of heart disease, you haven't had angina, you've not got a stent, you haven't had a heart attack, and you haven't had a temporary stroke or even a significant stroke, then there's no benefit from aspirin in that situation. There's been a very large Australian and international trial done on that, which we had on the health report. Where aspirin does help, and it's almost an imperative, unless there's really strong indications that you shouldn't, is if you have got a sign of heart disease. Just to repeat myself, it's angina, it's a stent, you've had to have an intervention, or you've had a heart attack, or you've had a temporary stroke, or a stroke itself. So those are the situations where aspirin is incredibly useful at low dose, 75 or 100 milligrams a day. And those circumstances, yes, you do want to reduce cholesterol, because what might seem like a normal cholesterol is probably too high for you. And
if you're talking about statins now.
Yeah, that's right. So statins do go along with this to if you've already had a heart event. And sometimes you'll need statins even though your cholesterol looks normal. And sometimes you will need anti-blood pressure medication even though your blood pressure looks normal to really reduce your risk very, very significantly. Now, aspirin for preventing colorectal cancer is a real phenomenon. And this is in people who, when you've had your colonoscopy, so you get your bowel cancer screening, you do your fecal occult blood test, you have a colonoscopy and they find a polyp, or maybe more than one, you know, two or three polyps. Aspirin in that situation has been shown to prevent the recurrence of benign polyps. And if they can prevent the recurrence of benign polyps, are the precursor, well, some versions of the benign polyps are precursors to cancer. So indirectly, aspirin can prevent the course to colon cancer. But it's again in a situation where you've been shown to have polyps rather than just blindly taking it.
And speaking of blindly taking things, please do not blindly take the advice that you get on the health report. This is food for the conversation that you have with your doctor.
Which is the equivalent of Tegan kicking me under the table.
Well, that's it for the mailbag today. If you'd like to kick Norman under the table, send us an email at healthreport@abc.net.au or kick me. We love all your kicks via email.
And if you've got questions about COVID or vaccines, go to our Coronacast website and we will answer them on Coronacast.
That's right. So many podcasts, so many answers.
Too many. Let's go. See you next time.